KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. When do you decide it's time to remove a ventilator, and how do you let a loved one die? We're going to hear more about that later this hour. And after 10 o'clock, columnist John Talton joins us to talk about an economic recovery that's stuck in second gear. It looks like Seattle voters will choose between incumbent Mayor Mike McGinn and State Senator Ed Murray in November's mayoral race. Murray was the top vote getter yesterday with just over 30% of the ballots. The mayor surprised even his own pollsters by taking 27%. Peter Steinbrück is holding firm on third place, but he is about 10 percentage points behind Mayor McGinn. Joining me to talk more about the early returns, KOW reporter Deborah Wong, who covered the Seattle mayoral primary and the Seattle City Council races. Also with us, KOW editor Derek Wong. And let's start with Seattle. Well, those were McGinn supporters at a campaign party last night. And Deb Wong, were they relieved, surprised, or were they just happy about their candidate's second place showing?
Well, our colleague David Hyde was there, and he tells me that people were absolutely ecstatic. It was probably the result that they were hoping for. It was a definitive, it was a clear second place showing, because there were worries that there would be kind of a bunch of candidates vying for second and that the results might not be known until later returns. But this was a good result for McGinn.
Well, so how did the mayor respond?
Well, he took to the stage after results were posted. And even though he is the incumbent mayor of the city of Seattle, he cast himself as the underdog in this race.
You know, I was thinking about 4 years ago. 4 years ago, they said, how is this neighborhood and environmental activist from Seattle going to win a mayor's race? And, you know, 4 years later, they're still asking it. But you know what? You're proving them wrong!
Okay, so he's making that sound a bit like a victory speech. How is it a success then that he came in second?
Well, I think it is because, you know, at least he survived. He had been suffering from very low poll numbers. He was seen as vulnerable. And remember, the last two mayors of the city of Seattle lost their jobs in the primary, including Greg Nichols, who he beat.
Right.
So the results were good for the campaign. His own strategist earlier in the day, John Weibel, had been telling reporters, including us, that McGinn might not be even in the top two on election night, which was sort of amazing that he would say that. But his explanation was that older voters, more conservative voters, tend to vote in the primary. So he said it wouldn't be a defeat if he wasn't in the top two, but that his voters would come through in the later returns.
So what is the explanation that it didn't quite happen that way?
Well, John Weibel says that the polls have been wrong. He says that the polls tend to reach out to voters who have landlines in their homes, so people who have cell phones don't get counted, and he thinks that accounts for like a 5% difference
Wow.
in the poll numbers. But he also says that in the final days of the campaign, something happened which he thinks boosted McGinn's numbers. McGinn came out against this building of this Whole Foods in West Seattle, and Weibel thinks that that actually boosted McGinn's support among his supporters.
Well, I think a lot of people were trying to figure out, okay, what do these people stand for? Which one of them is, you know, kind of reflects my values? I think the Whole Foods issue for a lot of folks, oh, okay, this guy gets it. This guy gets where my life is, and, you know, it will really take a principled stand. You know, you set up on the stage, you know what I believe in, and I think that's one thing you can say about this mayor. You know where he stands.
Well, so who are the supporters of McGinn?
Well, you know, he has the same coalition that he had 4 years ago, the bicyclists, the pedestrian activists, some environmental activists as well. This year he has he also has low wage labor unions like the grocery workers, the hotel workers. He's got the machinists on his side this year. And interestingly enough, a very vocal group that's been supporting McGinn has been Sonics fans, basketball fans, because they consider McGinn the one true champion of the arena plan down in SoTo. And so they've been working hard to get him reelected as well.
You, I understand, were at Ed Murray's campaign party, and we heard the uproarious reaction of four more years. What happened when they announced the vote tally?
Well, this was really odd. I think the contrast is, if people were anxious at the McGinn campaign, they were supremely confident at the Murray campaign. Everyone expected that Murray would get through the top two, and many people felt that he would end up number one. So I think when the numbers were released, there was absolutely no reaction. People kept drinking. They were having a great time. And it wasn't until Murray took to the stage they actually started chanting.
Murray, throughout this race, has I'm not sure if underplayed the issues is really the thing, but his whole message has been, I'm inclusive, I can reach out to people. He hasn't really talked about issues. Did he address any issues last night?
Well, he did bring up those same themes, that this is a city that's been divided, that's been polarized. McGinn has been a divisive leader. He wants to be a collaborator. He wants to bring people together. I mean, we've heard this over, as you said, over and over again. He brought up this sort of typical progressive themes, helping the homeless, improving education, expanding opportunities for the poor. But he did add a couple of new things that I hadn't heard before. For example, he criticized McGinn for not having enough women in positions of leadership in the government.
And when it comes to the issue of equity, under the last mayor, 48% of the department heads of the city of Seattle were women. Today, 70% of the department heads are men. I believe the talent is out there, and I promise you, we will have a city leadership as diverse as the city itself.
And that is the front runner in yesterday's mayoral primary. That's State Senator Ed Murray. We're talking with KUOW's Deb Wong and Derek Wong standing by. Want to bring into our conversation the man who's holding third place in balloting. It's candidate and former Seattle City Council member Peter Steinbrook, who joins me now. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
As I understand it, you aren't ready to concede this election. Is that correct?
I slept on it, and yes, I congratulate the successful primary candidates, Senator Murray and Mayor Mike McGinn. I congratulate them on their success.
Oh,
and I've called them both.
What do you think were the factors that tipped the election towards both of them?
Well, I'm personally appalled by the amount of independent expenditure that has gone into the other campaigns. It sets up an unequal playing field. That being said, I think we've had a good discussion about leadership styles and form. Now we need to talk about substance.
And what would you like to see addressed during the rest of this campaign?
Well, I would like to see a serious and robust discussion, a debate, if you will, that is participated in by the entire city over the future of our city and where we're going. What direction are we going, and how are we going to handle the challenges ahead of densification, our transportation challenges, environmental goals, and education, those kinds of things? We need to have that serious discussion about leadership, a specific effective leadership in the key areas that are important to our future. I also hope that the neighborhoods won't be left behind. We have such great neighborhoods in Seattle.
Peter, who will you endorse in this race?
Well, I'm going to take my time and think about that a little bit. I'm going on a canoe trip up the Duwamish, and I may be doing a little bit of camping. And right now, I just finished two laps around Green Lake waiting for this call. So I'm going to enjoy a little bit of the summer before it's gone.
It sounds like you need to have a little drink there, a little raspy. Is that too much campaigning?
Well, I've been doing a lot of talking, I'll say that. And I think, yes, my throat has gotten raspy.
I just have a last question, and it's about that issue of neighborhoods, because you really did put yourself in that mode. You were the candidate of the neighborhoods and for the neighborhoods. And I'm curious who you saw as your main foot soldiers in this election.
Yes. Excuse me. A car just went by. I think my support was deep and broad throughout the city, coming from more of a place of grassroots support. Women and men, old and young, in between, people of color have supported my campaign. In the end, there weren't enough votes there. And it takes a lot of resource to reach the voters directly. It takes a tremendous amount of resource financially, sweat, hitting the streets, phone banking, all of that. And so I feel very good about the broad support that I have received, the enthusiasm, the grassroots, the volunteerism in my campaign has been absolutely outstanding, and I thank everyone who helped me in this effort.
Well, Peter Steinbrück, thank you so much for taking time to join us. I hope you have a good canoe trip.
Thanks very much. I'm excited to be going.
That's Peter Steinbrück, who took third place in yesterday's primary and conceding on our air. And so we have two candidates for mayor of Seattle, Mike McGinn and Ed Murray, joined by KUOW's Deb Wong, who's been covering this election, and Derek Wong, our assignment editor, both of whom you just heard it here first. Well, okay, so now we know who the mayoral candidates. Let's move on, Deb. You covered also city council races. There were several of them open, and there weren't, it seems, a lot of surprises.
Not a lot of surprises. Only two races on the primary ballot, two races that had more than two contestants. Mike O'Brien is a first-term city council member and a close ally of Mike McGinn. He was, I guess, regarded as vulnerable because his challenger, who is was not well known, Albert Shen, but did raise more money than him in this primary campaign, was considered a formidable challenger just because of he's raised a lot of money. But Mike O'Brien is handily beating Albert Shen. In the other race, Richard Conlin, who's a 16-year incumbent of the of the city council, he will be facing Kshama Sawant, who is a member of the Socialist Alternative Party. And we remember her here because she ran against Frank Chop for the state legislature last year. She is interesting, and this will be an interesting race, because she is a very aggressive campaigner. She's made the $15 minimum wage her issue, and she's calling for a millionaire's tax. And she calls Richard Conlin a corporate shill. So it will be probably an interesting race.
As I understand it, Richard Conlin did not pull 50% of the vote.
Just under 50%. He had two challengers. His other challenger, Brian Carver, is also a newcomer, an Amazon Kindle manager. He, even though he raised more money than Kshama Sawant, he came in third.
Interesting. We'll look ahead to your coverage this fall. Derek Wong, let's widen the lens a little bit, looking at King County. Let's start at the top. County Executive Dow Constantine was on the ballot facing, I believe, four challengers.
Yeah, he had multiple challengers, and he is crushing it right now. The last check from last night's first release of tallies, he has about 76%. So I think it's safe to say he's going to go on to November. The second place finisher in that race is a civil engineer, Alan Lobdell. There are also two council races, and both incumbents have appear to be going through to the November ballot. Incumbent Rod Dembowski, this is the newest council member. He's taken on Bob Ferguson's seat, who's now the attorney general. He'll be facing, or it looks like he'll be facing, healthcare professional Naomi Wilson. He leads her by about 45 points. And incumbent Reagan Dunn, who was also a candidate for AG and lost, he seems to be leading his race. The second place challenger in that race is Sherry Song. I think she trails him by 21 points.
That's quite a gap in both those races.
Yeah, so not a lot of surprises at the county level.
You know, it's interesting. The one ballot measure was a parks levy, and everybody thought, and it is a shoe-in, I think, 68-69% of the vote right now. But this was, there was some contention that sort of emerged late in the race about, it was claimed that it was not an increase in taxes when, in fact, it is an increase.
It certainly is. The existing levy that it's replacing is about 13.4 cents per $1,000 of assessed value. This new levy is, you know, almost 19 cents for every $1,000 of assessed value. So for the owner of a $300,000 home, it works out to be $56 a year. And one of the things that we've covered here on KUW with the news team is that, you know, unlike the city, the county completely funds the park system through these levies. And they're also looking to acquire new land, and they're hoping to, you know, develop that east side trail with this money, so it's going to go to a lot of things.
So in other words, there's no general operating fund money that goes to the King County Park system?
Exactly. Well, whereas the city of Seattle, they use some general fund money as well.
I guess we neglected to talk. We're still in Seattle. There were a few school board races as well in Seattle, and I know Ann Dornfeld, who's our education reporter, covered them. One was an unopposed race, Betty Patu running for re-election, and so she sails on. The other The other two, they call them directorships, mm-hmm. were more hotly contested, and sort of the vision for the district itself is on the line, I think.
Yeah, and in one race in particular, there's an amazing margin. In District 5, that's the Capitol Hill, Central Area, Leschi, Beacon Hill, parts of downtown. Stephen Blandford, he's an educational policy consultant. He has 78% of the vote. So he's doing really well in that race. District 4, that's Ballard, Queen Anne, Magnolia, Belltown. The leading candidate in that race is Suzanne Del Este. She leads Sue Peters by about, I think, 7 percentage points. So that'll be a tighter race probably.
And Sue Peters is the candidate that comes out of the sort of reform, non-testing group, a lot of concerned parents backing her, and Suzanne Del Este is, some people have labeled her the establishment candidate, but there's a real split in vision for where the district goes, and I know that Ann Dornfelt will be covering this throughout the fall. And finally, the last really interesting race, before we talk about some of the issues in the fall, was in Bellevue, and this is really about where the city of Bellevue goes from here.
It's so interesting, and it would be interesting to follow. I mean, it could be, a sign of changing demographics. But we should first back up and say that, you know, the Bellevue City Council is often split between its liberal and conservative wings, 4-3. I think it's technically a nonpartisan council position, but they do vote along party lines, you know, anti-taxes versus, you know, more government services, that kind of thing. And there's a longtime city council member there, Don Davidson. He's been there 6 terms. He's an establishment guy. He's in the fight for his political life. He is in 3rd place right now. The first place finisher in that race is Lynn Robinson. She's a physical therapist. She has 48% of the vote. The second place finisher is Vandana Slatter. She works for Amgen, a biotech company. She's also a former member of the State Board of Pharmacy. She leads the incumbent, Don Davidson, by 142 votes.
And what's also interesting is that Vandana Slatter put in a lot of money. As I understand it, she raised the most money of any Bellevue City Council candidate ever.
Right. She even boasted to the Seattle Times about that, which is interesting. Yes, her last time we checked, her campaign coffers were, you know, north of $100,000.
Well, so we move from Bellevue, where it doesn't seem like money made a lot of difference, back to you, Deb Wong, where we heard Peter Steinbrück a few minutes ago cite money as the major factor in perhaps his 3rd place showing.
Yeah, and you know, I would question that, because remember last mayor's race when Mike McGinn and Joe Malahan were going against each other? Joe Malahan far outraised Mike McGinn, but what McGinn had was organizational support. He had a lot of endorsements. He had Sierra Club folks, he had Cascade Bicycle Club, and those became his foot soldiers in getting out the vote. Peter Steinbrück decided early on in this race that he was not going to raise a lot of money. He was not going to spend the time on the phone, coaxing donors out of their, out of their dollars. So he was at a disadvantage in from early on. But he also didn't really have the big endorsements. He didn't have the organizational support that could make up for any deficit in dollars.
And as you heard, when we asked him who his foot soldiers were, he said they were neighborhood folks. He's not making an endorsement at this point. He's going off canoeing, which is probably a well-needed rest. And it brings us to looking ahead to the next 3 months or so as we get ready for the general race. There is no rest for Mike McGinn and Ed Murray. And I'm wondering, when you talk endorsements, how do you see these two candidates? Who are their camps? How will we see this progress?
I think it's very interesting in terms of the contrasts in who their followers are. Ed Murray had as his the base of his campaign operation, the R74 folks, the people who were active in the referendum for gay marriage, for same-sex marriage last year. They basically just like slotted into Ed Murray's campaign. Ed Murray has business behind him. He's got a lot of Democratic Party establishment support. He's got elected officials. He is the establishment candidate, essentially. Mm-hmm. Mike McGinn has the same, bicycle, environmental, Sarah Club coalition. He's got the low wage unions. He's got a lot of support in the South End among ethnic groups. And he's got the Sonics fans. So two very different coalitions backing these folks. And I think it's going to be a very, very, very tough, tight race.
Any issues you think that are going to float to the top?
Well, you know, beyond the sort of, you know, Murray talking about collaboration and bringing the city together, you know, I was listening very carefully to Mike McGinn's speech last night, just reading between the lines. He used a couple of phrases that I thought were interesting. He said, I have taken principled stands on issues. He said that several times, I suppose, in defense of his divisiveness. You know, he basically says, I just take strong stands and I believe in them. But he also said, you know where I stand. And he said that a couple of times. And I think that may be a reference to Ed Murray not really being clear on some of his specific stands on issues. I think McGinn is going to pound him on specific city issues that maybe Murray is not all that familiar with, being in the legislature. So we're going to probably see a little more specificity in the coming months.
KOW's Deb Wong covers politics, been covering the mayoral race, Seattle City Council race. Derek Wong, our assignment editor, giving us a wrap-up of just some of the races that were on yesterday's primary election ballot, and we look ahead to November. Thanks, both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
And you can follow election news on our website at kuow.org/elections. 66 degrees in Seattle, and, well, it's sunny. It's going to stay sunny today, and we're looking at a high of 85. Tomorrow, some morning clouds, then sunny again with a high of 82.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Symphony, presenting its 2013-2014 season, featuring concerts like Verdi's Requiem, Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, and Carl Orff's Carmina Burana. Tickets are now on sale by calling the box office or at seattlesymphony.org.
It's 9:28. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's been a month since that big oil train explosion in eastern Canada. What do we now know about what happened? We'll get an update after the 10 o'clock news.
This is Weekday. I'm Kitty Sewell. Imagine having to decide when to remove an injured loved one from a ventilator. Some of you have actually had to make that decision already. Doctors have to make it too. Every situation is unique, and it's not simply a medical decision. It can be ethical and emotional as well. Jim DeMaine is a retired pulmonary critical care doctor who frequently gives talks to patients about planning for end-of-life issues. He joins me to talk about some patients who wanted to be taken off a ventilator and allowed to die. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Katie. This is a difficult situation, and it happens nearly every day in intensive care units around the country. If you look at deaths in the intensive care unit, about 70% of them are related to withdrawal of a ventilator. It's usually situations where everything else has been tried. You're continuing lung support, but everything else has failed, and it's time to let the patient go. But it's never an easy decision. It's very frequently a bumpy road. And I'd like to tell you about a few cases where we made a decision. You try to do shared decision-making with the patient if they're alert and, of course, with the loved ones. And if somebody has durable power of attorney for health care, then they're speaking for the patient. But one fellow, I'll call him George, I'm obviously changing names here, he was in his mid-70s. And he was up on a ladder cleaning out gutters, which I really don't advise people much over 65 to do. But anyway, while he was up on a ladder, he actually had a heart attack. And he fell, hit the ground in an awkward way, and broke his neck. His wife heard him hit the ground, called 911, and they were able to revive him, get his heart started, and admitted him to the hospital. Unfortunately, he was completely paralyzed. It was a high cervical fracture, so he couldn't move any of his limbs, and he couldn't breathe on his own. So he was on a ventilator, but his brain was functioning fine. He was in a situation like Christopher Reeves was, Superman, after he had his fall. Other people that are totally ventilator-dependent, probably Stephen Hawking is one of the best known. That was more of a neuromuscular disease. But anyway, he ended up having a tracheotomy, a hole in his throat with a little cuff tube put in, and he had rehab, was actually able to go home. His wife had a lot of resources. She was a very good caregiver, almost over the top, getting everything organized. They had a swimming pool. She put concrete blocks around the pool so his wheelchair couldn't fall in there. He was had a specialized trach tube, so he was able to talk in kind of a stutter step kind of way. He was able to guide his wheelchair just with breath, making it go left, right, or stop. And yet he required total body care. He was unable to do anything for himself, and he began to have recurrent respiratory infections. He couldn't cough. He couldn't clear secretions. So there's various maneuvers used with machines to try to induce cough. He hated the suctioning, which is very uncomfortable and produces a gag and cough reflex. And he required hospitalization first year a couple of times. The bacteria started getting more resistant. Each time he got admitted, it was kind of a crisis. We had to kind of clean out his airways and try to get him going again. And in the second year, when I was there with him, said, you know, I think this is enough. I've gone on long enough. And his wife heard that, though, and said, no way. I want you to keep going. And she really pushed hard. And he did keep going into a third year. And he was on his fourth or fifth hospitalization. And he told me, he said, my quality of life, from my vantage, is zero. He said, I'm not functioning like a man. I can't do any of the things I want to do. I know my wife loves me, but my quality of life is just horrible. I really can't go on living like this. Social workers met with the wife, and gradually she saw that it was his choice. And so she went along with him, and they had a prayer vigil around the bed. They had all their support people there. And we fairly heavily sedated him. Because not being able to breathe at all would be like suffocating. So we heavily sedated him, and he died comfortably. But it's still, as a physician at the bedside, it's a godlike kind of thing, you know, where you're making these life and death decisions. But his was gradually made over time, and it was one that he was comfortable and finally his wife was comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell you another case on the flip side, if you'd like.
Well, is it just that does the decision become any easier for you as a doctor to support if it's something that's more long-term than if it's very short-term, or is it the vice versa?
Well, it depends on the whole situation. I got a call one time from a family, and they said our mother is being transferred from the burn unit to your hospital, and we want her taken off the ventilator. Talk about short term.
Wow.
That's
why transfer?
That's why I said, wow. And I said, well, let's meet at the bedside and we'll talk. But it was a difficult situation. She was in a house fire and was well up in her 80s. And her quality of life was marginal to begin with. And she had such severe burns, she required support on a ventilator. She had a number of significant grafts done. But then she started going into the other organs were failing, the kidneys were failing, heart wasn't doing well. But sometimes, you know, when you get on a specialized unit like a burn unit, their focus is on burn care, let's get you through this, let's get the wounds healed. And they just felt like they weren't being communicated with, and so they demanded the transfer.
Mm.
And in that situation, we didn't have too much trouble, actually, that same day with the family was so adamant and the woman's condition was so poor that we basically let her go.
Mm-hmm.
The burn doctor called me up the next day and wondered how the grafts were doing, and I had to kind of, you know, gently say, I'm sorry, but we acceded to their wishes. And he wasn't really very happy about that. But sometimes there is this technology driver that keeps you going once you get in a high-tech environment, and it's hard to say, when are we going to switch from this curative kind of heroic mode to just care for comfort.
Mm-hmm. And in some ways, the ventilator itself is that thing that can keep you going, just like in the story you were just telling.
Yeah, ventilators, they're wonderful when they work. I actually had a tetanus case many years ago in Wisconsin, and that patient required to be on a ventilator for months before he came around and yet survived. They can be wonderful when there's an acute situation. It's like a splint. It supports your lungs. It supports your breathing while we're doing other things.
I'm speaking with Jim DeMaine, who's a retired pulmonary critical care doctor. He's also an emeritus clinical professor of medicine at the University of Washington and a member of the Hospital Ethics Committee. And he writes a blog called endoflifeblog.com. So you said that you had a contrasting story to the story of the man.
Yeah, you know, generally the ethical rule in medicine is, first of all, do no harm, but you want to respect the patient's autonomy. And also there's a principle called beneficence where you want to do good, basically. And this was a situation that a young fellow with a young family, the wife decided that she was going to can some asparagus, a home canning technique, but it wasn't done properly. You have to use pressure cooker at a certain level to make sure everything is killed off. Long story short, he was the only one, fortunately, in the family brave enough to eat the asparagus, but he developed acute botulism poisoning. Botulism's a bacteria that can grow in a situation where there's no oxygen, and that was a perfect situation for it to grow and start producing toxin. And when the toxin's ingested, it basically causes paralysis. The nerves no longer communicate with each other, and you start getting blurred vision, maybe some nausea and vomiting. The face becomes flaccid, and then the limbs become flaccid. And that's the way he presented. He was in acute distress and required going on a ventilator. Everything else was working fine. His brain was alert, body functions were fine, all the organs were fine. And the outlook, we did give him antitoxin, which didn't seem to have much effect, but the outlook was for him, in a matter of 4, 6, even a little bit longer weeks, that he could recover completely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he started to get a little bit better, but we were out at 4 weeks. And even with sedation and whatnot, he began demanding to be taken off the ventilator and allowed to die. He could not see beyond his immediate circumstance. And it's a little bit dicey. It's almost like assault when you're going against somebody's wishes and doing something to them that they don't want. So this was ethically problematic. Morally, it wasn't problematic to me. No, we're keeping you on a respirator. The wife and the two kids were saying, don't let daddy die. So
was that an immediate thought for you as soon as he asked? Do you have to sort of consider his point of view, or were you immediately thinking...
saying no way. This is where the ethical principle of do no harm or beneficence. It's unusual to trump autonomy. There are situations where this is a very unusual one where we did. Most of the time, you really should accede to the patient's wishes. So this is the exception to the rule. He actually asked for a lawyer, and the lawyer came in and saw him, and there was some discussion about getting a guardian appointed that might be more neutral than the family, but that never really went anywhere. The lawyer said, I'm not going to tell them to take. He had the same reaction as me. You're going to get better. And it was kind of interesting because he did recover. He did get out of the hospital. Of course, wife and kids were delighted to have him back. And I saw him back in the office and said, how do you feel about this? He said, obviously I'm really happy to be alive. But he said, part of me is really pissed off at you guys that you didn't listen to me. So he was still conflicted that was the situation. But I think in his heart, he was happy to be there. There are situations, though, there was one situation where a very, very bad fire where, not one I was involved with, where the patient begged to die when the medics found them. Just let me go. This is horrible. But they did saved the patient, went through horrible scars and burns and whatnot, and actually later sued, apparently, for wrongful life. Those usually happen in children, but there are occasional adult cases where we don't listen to somebody that wants to die. So that, it's problematic.
Is that part of the machine, the training, that you want to be the heroic helper that gets this person through this horrible event?
Well, you know, if Medic One arrives and they do their thing, and then they get burn care, it's very hard then to stop. You know, once you begin the technology and you see the patient is surviving despite all the pain and everything else, it's kind of like somebody said, "Well, I would never go through that chemotherapy again," you know, mm-hmm. and. Here, the patient didn't have any choice, though. They were kind of in the intensive unit getting the treatment.
Jim DeMaine is a retired pulmonary critical care doctor. He's also an emeritus clinical professor of medicine at the University of Washington and a member of the Hospital Ethics Committee. He frequently gives talks to patients about planning for end-of-life issues, and he writes about a lot of these issues at his blog, endoflifeblog.com. A lot of people don't have a living will or even a will in general, put together that gives you some sort of instruction on what to do if the patient is not conscious. The two that you give an example of when we're talking about whether to keep someone on a ventilator or not were both conscious and thinking clearly.
Right.
How do you negotiate the ethics and the emotion when a person is not conscious and the decision needs to be made one way or the other? Or it could be delayed even for weeks and weeks.
It's really tough. I mean, sometimes when I'm conferencing with families, you have to say, well, just imagine that your mom was here in the room. What would she be telling us if you don't have very clear advance directive? I did have one very strange one where, in a way, the woman wasn't competent. She had Alzheimer's and was in a care facility. But she developed what we call aplastic anemia. The bone marrow just was not producing red blood cells. So about every 2 weeks, she needed transfusions in order to keep going. And I kind of watched this from a distance. I was never involved directly in her care, but they don't allow transfusions in extended care facilities, so she would have to come into the emergency room, have transfusions there. But as soon as she came into this environment, she became disruptive, disoriented, screaming. She thought she was being attacked when needles were put in for the blood. And then she'd have to be admitted, sedated, and admitted to the hospital. And then she had a very stormy care. And the worst place for an Alzheimer's patient is in the intensive care unit. So this is a very strange ethical dilemma. I was on call one weekend when this happened again, and I said, I'm going to take the bull by the horn. I really need to talk to this family and see if they really want these transfusions to continue, because mom was really very severely impaired and didn't recognize them and had very severe Alzheimer's. So I talked to them, and the son and the daughter said, I think that we should stop these transfusions. But the husband stood up and said, this is like Dachau, and he walked out. So we were at an impasse. So I didn't know quite what to do, but I said, how about if I talk to your dad tomorrow? I'll have him come in and we'll talk. And so I didn't know quite how to approach it. He came in. The thing is, he had early dementia himself, but they were deferring to him. So I said, you know, in a way, I think these transfusions might be harming your wife. And he said, you know, you're right. I said, why do you think I'm right? Well, she might get AIDS. And this is very thin ethical ice. But based on that, he went along with the idea she should have no more transfusions. And she was allowed to just die peacefully out in a nursing home. Mm-hmm. But that was unusual.
Did they teach you how to deal with these ethical dilemmas as part of your medical training?
I wasn't really taught so much, but I know at the University of Washington they have programs for training students and physicians. And Randy Curtis there, who heads up the pulmonary department, they've now got a consortium of palliative care at the UW, and they're reaching out to the communities, even people like myself, to join this coalition and to try to coordinate that kind of thing. But it's not not always clear. I did have one patient that came in with a rupturing abdominal aortic aneurysm. The big artery in the abdomen was about to burst, and she had emergency surgery to put in a plastic aorta, basically. And post-operatively, she went into shock, and bad things started happening with her kidneys and her lungs, and she had to be on life support on a ventilator. She was probably 76, good health otherwise, but she was very, very ill. She developed what we call the adult respiratory distress syndrome, where the lungs shut down, kidneys were marginal, heart function was marginal, liver functions were marginal, but she was hanging in there. She developed multiple infections, even at one point had a fungus growing out of her blood. And this went on for about 6 weeks. And we kept having discussions about this. Her son was a firefighter, and he was, come on, mom, you're going to get better. He'd always talk to her. We're going to go to Puerto Vallarta and have a beer, mom. Come on, let's go. And the rest of us were kind of starting to wear out. The nurses were beginning to question whether it was reasonable to keep this going and going. But we couldn't see anything that was truly terminal, and she was still having some possibility of making it, probably less than 20%. But, you know, we kept going, and suddenly one day everything turned around. It was just almost miraculous, and everything started to improve. We were able to get her off the ventilator, and we sent her off to assisted care. Now, this is part of the story nobody's going to believe. But I kind of lost track of her. She went out to a rehab facility, and it was spring vacation, and I was on with my kids and wife, and we were heading off to Puerto Vallarta. We were down at SeaTac Airport. I was standing in line there, and suddenly I hear this voice kind of shouting out, "There's my doctor! You saved my life!" And it was this woman, I'll call Sally, and I didn't recognize her because she looked like a little old lady, you know. Just so we chatted a little bit, but we were on the same flight to Puerto Vallarta, which was really amazing. So it was a nice follow through.
Yeah, when it comes to these big questions, if anybody's it's a family member or loved one that's on a ventilator right now, or if they want to plan for an unknown future, is there any way to navigate what's the right thing to do as a patient?
Well, I think for the very frail elderly, there's a point where we need to let go. Atul Gawande has an article he wrote in, I think it was in the New Yorker, called Letting Go, where we can always find one more thing to do. So I think it's, again, shared decision-making, where it's between the loved ones and the family, looking at the medical status, getting a very honest opinion from the medical providers. What is the real outlook? There's some people that want to keep going, even if it's less than 1% chance, but that becomes unrealistic. And there's situations where perhaps we shouldn't even offer a ventilator. Can I tell you another story?
Sure.
Okay. This was one weekend. I was not too far along in my medical practice. It was probably back in the late 70s. I was rounding on a Sunday. I was covering a cancer patient. It was a young boy who had osteogenic sarcoma of the leg. And the family had believed in faith healing. And he had had no treatment, just prayer. And unfortunately, the tumor had now spread into his lungs and throughout his body, and he was having all kinds of breathing difficulty. And the family was struggling with their decision, their guilt. And psychiatrist was there with them. And I came in as a new provider, just rounding on weekend coverage with this situation, and found that it had never been clarified whether he would be moved to the intensive care unit and what kind of intervention might be done. And I thought it would be almost cruel and unusual to offer a ventilator to a patient like this. So I was making this one-sided decision, if you will, that we needed to do something. The family was medically naive. They didn't know a ventilator or an ICU or anything. And so what I did offer was an old kind of breathing machine called a Bird respirator, which was invented by Dr. Bird during the polio epidemic to support all the kids during the 50s and beyond that had polio. But anyway, we did support him that way, and the nurses gave him sedation, and he was allowed to die. So sometimes it's not right to move people into that high-tech environment. But for families, the best thing to do is to have the discussions ahead of time to really clarify values. I had a lady ask me today, well, I'm so fearful of Alzheimer's, can I just have them give me an injection at the end? And that's not allowable. And it would probably be dangerous because one of the fears of the Death for Dignity Act is that it could be abused if we start allowing injections for the elderly and disabled. So the best thing if you're deciding on a ventilator is hopefully have the advance directive in place, but most importantly is to identify a loved one for a durable power of attorney so that if you can't speak, they can speak for you.
Jim DeMaine is a retired pulmonary critical care doctor. He's also an emeritus clinical professor of medicine at the University of Washington and a member of the Hospital Ethics Committee. He frequently gives talks to patients about planning for end-of-life issues, and he writes about a lot of these issues at his blog, endoflifeblog.com. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Katie.
This is Weekday.
It's 9:52. The sound of an anguished parrot in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the Technology Management MBA at the University of Washington Foster School of Business, an 18-month MBA on the East Side for technology leaders and innovators. Information session tonight in Kirkland or August 15th online. Registration at foster.washington.edu/apply now.
67 degrees in Seattle with some of those high wispy clouds like brushstrokes across the sky. Forecast says we should expect sun today and a high of 85. A bit later this morning, film critic Robert Horton joins us to evaluate the last films of great actors and directors. Robert says some made graceful exits and some didn't. He shares his thoughts with us in 30 minutes.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Parrots, like all pets, need to have checkups, and that means a trip to the avian vet. As part of our On the Job series, Katie Sewell visited the Bird and Exotic Clinic of Seattle.
Imagine a large gray parrot. She has sharp black beak, talons that need trimming, and a calm demeanor, at least at first. Avian specialist Tracy Bennett is about to give the big gray bird its annual exam at the Bird and Exotic Clinic of Seattle. So, how do you examine a large bird that flies and bites? I found out. You wrap it in a towel. How does the bird feel? Like this.
Oh, I know it's not that bad, is it? Oh, what a good gray baby. Poor gray parrot. Poor gray parrot. That's not the noises we were hoping you would make. Those are bad noises. We're sorry, baby. Let's read your banner. Okay, BR Florida. So you're from Florida, huh? You're a Floridian?
Do most of them have bands?
It's technically a federal law that it's illegal to sell an unbanded bird, but it's not enforced, and it comes from the days when people were still smuggling them and things like that, which really, there's actually an excess of birds in the U.S., so they're not, there's no demand for smuggling anymore.
Listening to its heart?
Yeah, and it's very loud. Their little hearts beat very fast. Okay, we're almost done with your pedicure, ma'am. All right, babe, let's get you out of there.
Are you the main vet to the birds that come here?
Yeah, I'm a board-certified bird specialist, of which there are only four of us in the state of Washington. So,
what's the most common problem that birds have that you see?
Nutritional disease is number one. People don't feed them correctly. Parrots, even little budgies, cockatiels, they're all citizens. They're in the parrot family, and they do not eat seeds. In the wild, they don't eat safflower and sunflower seeds. They eat other kinds of low-fat seeds, but they don't eat those oil seeds like safflower and sunflower. So people think they do, and that causes a huge amount of problems nutritionally.
Do you have birds at your own house?
Oh, yeah. I have seven parrots.
So tell me, is it weird owning animals that might outlive you?
I like it, though. I mean, I just had to put one of my dogs to sleep that was old and sick, and I hate that. Like, I like the fact that they're going to live, and I won't have to see them get old and sick. So I also have tortoises, which live forever, too. So I find that an attractive aspect of that owning them.
What about with the talking in parrots? Do they ever learn to say things that you would prefer they didn't say?
Surprisingly, mine never have. I don't know why. but they say a lot of things, and they say it loudly when you have seven of them. Two of mine are girl Amazon parrots, and they like to have yelling contests.
You can just get used to it?
Oh, yeah. I don't even hear it. I'm completely immune.
That's avian specialist Tracy Bennett. She spoke with KOW's producer Katie Sewell. And now, the sound of the day. Sound familiar? Yesterday, oh, there it is. We asked you to identify this sound.
Is it another parrot?
No, I don't think. So, you heard also the fairy. That was the part everybody understood. Our weekday listener, Katie, hears this bird every night outside her home on Bainbridge. We asked you to identify the sound because she just said, I hear it. And quite a few of you wrote in to our Name This Sound mini contest. So here were some of your answers. Samantha and Nora think it's the sound of a stellar jay. Shannon says this is a northern flicker. Anne says her best guess is it's a baby great blue heron. Gitty in Port Townsend says it's the sound of a young towhee. She has one in her tree that screeches every evening. Mary Lou on Whidbey Island and Gail in Langley think it's a baby barred owl calling to its mother for food. So, essentially, we don't have the definitive answer to this question, but many of you are noticing that there seem to be a lot of baby birds that are starting out in their nests right now. So thanks for playing along with us. And what interesting sounds are you hearing? We would love for you to record 30 seconds of the sound around you and send it to us along with the definitive story behind the sound. Or I guess we can have more contests. Why not? Email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org and include sound of the day in the subject line. Coming up in the next hour of Weekday, Les Lane from Victoria fills in for vacationing Vaughn Palmer. Robert Horton joins us, and economic columnist John Talton talks about Jeff Bezos, the Washington Post, and housing. Hope you stay with us.
Did you know you can name KUOW as a beneficiary in your insurance policy or individual retirement account, and you might be eligible for additional financial benefits? The next time you review your long-term financial plans, consider including KUOW. For more information, go to kuow.org/future.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.